Hello and welcome to College Admissions with Mark and Anna. Each week we talk about different college admissions topics and answer those tough questions you may be dealing with concerning getting into the college of your choice. We know how stressful this process can be, so each episode we try to make it easier to navigate. Now, here are your hosts, Anna Wren and Mark Hofer.
Hi everyone, and welcome to a special edition episode where we have Steve from the College Admissions Toolbox. And we're here also with Mark and Anna. So how are you guys today? You want to all go around the room?
Yeah, sure. Very cool. I'll jump off. Hi, everybody. My name is Steve Schwartz. I host the College Admissions Toolbox as well as the College Admissions Toolbox website. So I'm also a fellow podcaster and sharing weekly tips on every aspect of the college admissions process. I've been doing this for over 10 years now. It kind of grew out of my own experience applying to college at Columbia University. Despite that fact that my grades and SAT scores were a bit below the norm, I got in part based on my extracurricular activities, which of course I'll dive into more later. But what I do is I help students highlight their extracurriculars in their college essays and every aspect of their application. But I'll leave off there for now.
Sounds great. You go next, Mark. We'll save me All right. for last.
Okay. My name is Mark Hofer. I'm a certified educational planner out in Seattle. Anna and I have the Mark and Anna's College Admissions Podcast, which we have been enjoying for the last couple of years. I work with students. I focus on STEM because of my background. I built spacecraft and rocket engines and spent 10 years in the classroom teaching all the sciences. And that's kind of my wheelhouse. But I enjoy helping students find the best college fit for them. And that does not mean name brand. So...
Nice. So I'm Anna Wren. Like I usually podcast with Mark. We wish we could talk to you guys weekly. We make it to maybe monthly. I'm actually from the East Coast as well. I'm from New Jersey. And I specialize with students that really focus on helping them stand out in their own way and creating genuine, authentic stories, whether it be through their activities, through I guess their essays and other things like that. I also have a big spot for first generation students because I was a first gen student myself. So I love working with them as well. And we're really excited to have you join us on this special episode where we'll be talking about, yes, the college admissions scandal, activities, and what an independent consultant can do for you, an ethical one.
You say scandal?
Scandal.
Scandal.
Yeah, it's funny. So I appreciate both of you being open to doing this sort of collaboration. I thought that it would be somewhat timely given the scandal making the news. And for those who aren't aware, I thought maybe we could break it down just a little bit in terms of the different things that were going on and then kind of hash out what it means for students and families. So as I understand it, it seemed like there were two big things going on. One was the SAT cheating side of things where proctors were bribed to give, you know, change answers on Scantrons and give extra time and things of that nature. And then on the flip side, there were some bribing of coaches to get students admitted as athletic admits, even though they didn't even play the sport at all. So that seemed like the two big things going on that I noticed. Did you guys notice anything else related to it that stood out?
I think those were the two significant things. And I think something to clarify, because some people were very surprised by the scandal. Others in the industry are not surprised by the scandal. I would say, I think there's a difference because some people don't really see the difference between donations and what happened this time around. And I think donations land in the school's pockets, whereas in this specific situation, it landed in individuals' pockets, which I think was the major issue.
Historically, we know, and like you say, Anna, but it shouldn't have been surprising to a lot of people that money has been used to influence admissions in one way, shape, or form for as long as there's been admissions. So, and there are different ways of that being used. If you buy a building for a college, does that give you a special treatment? And I think that's a very different thing from something when we're hearing, like, and like you mentioned, Steve, when somebody is paid to have your test scores change, that is a very different thing than I think, like we've noticed with the especially with athletics. If you're not going to play the sport and you're getting admitted, that is a very different thing. Those are, and that's, and somehow they've been lumped together as the same scandal. And I think that they're very different issues.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's it's interesting to me, as and I think your distinction was key, because the coaches here in this case, they were kind of abusing their position to not admit students who actually would enrich the school's community, help their athletic teams out. These were just people who, you know, let's say a coach could maybe take, I don't know, 10 people per year, no questions asked. And they're giving five of those slots to people who did not deserve it in any way, shape, or form. And you know, college is not only about academics, of course. Athletics and extracurriculars are a component of the college experience. And these students, it seems, might not have been bringing anything to the table in any of those categories.
Absolutely. I think one of the things in speaking with parents, one parent said to me that they looked, if somebody actually buys like a building for a college.
And you guys did see that in the news, right?
Yes. Okay. And provides millions of dollars to buy a wing that supports the legacy of ongoing education of other students as well. I had a parent who basically called that, you know, the education tax, in that, okay, I'm going to get my child in by buying a building that satisfies thousands of students for decades. And that's one of those, is this a gray area, or should this just not be legal, or where should we put that? If you're talking about someone who provides a couple hundred thousand dollars, and that money is never used to support educational materials within the mm-hmm. within the college itself, is that different? And that's where, you know, the conversation really needs to be had. And I think there are a number of universities who are now making sure they have those conversations. So I think more transparency is good.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was kind of thinking about it in a similar way, actually, that the idea that one person's donation of hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions could then trickle back down to all the students for several years, versus the coach just buying themselves a Ferrari or a mansion or something like that, where it doesn't really end up helping anybody. And I kind of thought of the analogy to a hospital, let's say. Yep. Someone buys a wing of a hospital, they get their name on it, and maybe they could jump the line for an organ donation or something. Maybe I could see that happening theoretically. And so you could make the argument potentially that those millions of dollars do end up still, you know, from like a utilitarian perspective, end up benefiting a great enough number of people that it's worth giving a little bit of special access to some extent. But right. Obviously there are gray areas there. It is hard to parse this out exactly. I'm thinking back to the robber barons, like the Rockefellers, yep. And the Carnegie and all, yep, of that, where, yeah, they did end up giving it back in some way over time to benefit the general public. But we don't see that happening in this scandal, of course.
Not in this one, no. And I think the other thing I think about is, and I think it has to do with me having gone on scholarship at, and my school is involved in the scandal. But what I would say is, and I got to meet my donors and everything like that, but there are families that donate and specify where that money should go. And quite honestly, I don't know if their donation helps make it possible for students of little means. And that means like maybe every year they're donating 10, 20, 100 spots so that kids without access to this education can get access. And the trade-off is one or two of their own children in the process. I kind of wonder, well, without those funds, would it be possible? So is it okay then?
A lot of people don't know that educational institutions and organizations, most of them operate under a 501c3. And part of their charter and their mission is that they actually cannot specifically select students for a particular opportunity. And it actually has to have outside influence. And so in your case, Anna, where you have a donor, they couldn't select you individually.
Correct.
A committee would have to select you and they would pair you. So that's one of the things that universities and colleges operate under very strict rules on how they're supposed to do that. And I think scandals like this just bring a little bit more tight microscopic look at how they're operating business, because they cannot afford to lose their charter. There are tax reasons for that and many other legal opportunities that if they were to lose their charter, that would end poorly.
Well, it's funny. I think that universities, you know, are such big bureaucracies that there are these little loophole areas like the athletics where they don't have the same degree of oversight. So if maybe 95% of students are chosen by committee with strict regulations and multiple people looking at every single application, sitting around the table making decisions, that at least has some degree of transparency.
Yep.
Then these athletic coaches, they get a free pass, you know, 10 students a cycle or whatever, no questions asked. They take those people, and the school kind of gives them this liberty where it says, we want our teams to do as well as possible by any means necessary. We're not going to ask questions about how it's done. And so the coaches should then theoretically go out and choose the strongest athletic applicants possible.
Yep.
But obviously there was some room where no one's really looking too closely at, well, did this applicant actually play the sport? Do we have any documentation of this? Usually someone who's worthy to be accepted as an athletic admit, you would think that by Googling them, you'd see them in a local paper or something, I would imagine.
That's true.
You'd hope, you know.
Yeah. Good thing. Yeah.
First level of check-in, you know, check and balance, where did they actually compete in high school? And it appears in some of these cases, they didn't. They didn't. I think one of they interviewed a coach of one of the soccer players who had been admitted and never played on the college team. And in their application, they had listed that they were recognized as all league, you know, player. And when they interviewed this coach at the high school level, he said, "I think I would know." Wow, that really slid under the radar.
But yeah, I would say that's where you could see that admissions failed, because yeah, admissions makes that ultimate decision, and they have. I think it depends on the school too, because I have had athletic recruits before for very elite universities, and at least in those situations, they've never told my student, "Oh, you're in." The review went smoothly. It's a likely, but no guarantees. So clearly, something went wrong in the admissions process at many of these schools.
I think as soon as any counselor who's ever done any amount of this, if they ever hear the words from somebody who says, "Oh, you're in," the red flag goes immediately up, and we start questioning where the universe is heading on this one. So
definitely, yeah, there are rarely promises or guarantees in this business. What do you all think about the SAT side of this with the proctors and the College Board in terms of them? Have you heard anything about them kind of double checking things going forward or kind of changing how they administer it? What allowed this to happen in the first place, really?
I know at the last conference I was at, not related to the scandal, but that there are steps in general, just because this is not College Board's first issue with fraud and things like that, unfortunately, that they are working towards a model where testing would be online eventually, and then it would be randomly generated questions the day of. So whenever I feel like that gets implemented, that for sure should cut down on the cheating, not just that goes on normally, but obviously in situations like this as well. I think the other concern is, and I don't know how to rectify this situation, the other part of the scandal was that kids were getting a pass in terms of getting extra time by qualifying for certain learning differences. And that, I think, is a harder situation to kind of go through.
Yeah, to be quite honest with you, I think that's really the biggest scandal of all, in a way. Because yeah, it's ongoing, and there's no way to really check it, because anyone who has the money can hire someone to give them the ADHD diagnosis, get 50% extra time or double time. And because we don't want to inadvertently block those from getting it who deserve it, we inevitably have to give it to those who don't deserve it. So it's kind of like innocent until proven guilty sort of thing.
There's a really interesting book called, and it's basically on drugging in sports, and it's called Spitting in the Soup. And there's a section of the book that talks about basically ADHD and the use of Ritalin and the use of amphetamines. And they basically identify studies that show there's a direct correlation between increased amount of test times and accommodations and tax base. So basically, if you are in a zip code with a high tax base, interesting fact that more students happen to have ADHD and have been diagnosed as such and have these accommodations. So that does make you wonder, and much like you said, Steve, If you want to talk about a real scandal, that's a place that, you know, we really need to look as well.
Yeah, Do you all think there's anything that could really be done to solve this sort of thing? Or is it just kind of like a blanket, yes, we're going to allow accommodations, or no, we're not?
Yeah. And if you take away, as a psychologist, if they were to take away all accommodations, it's almost one of those regressive tax things where the kids who need it the most and actually can compete at that level, if given the accommodation, suffer the most. And that's a slippery slope as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't know how they're going to solve that problem. That's the main problem. I think not everything else, but for the most part, other parts of the scandal can be resolved in terms of implementing stricter checks and balances. But that one really would be difficult just because you don't want to sacrifice. It would be like checking with everybody who commits social security fraud, right? That would be extremely arduous, but also, you know, with learning differences, how do you challenge that? Like, oh, does your kid really have a learning difference? But what I do think is good though, is that more and more schools are going test optional, so that is just a barrier removed, especially for those families in those non-high income zip codes that might not know to even ask for accommodations, to at least know that, hey, I just won't take the test in general.
With University of Chicago, bless their heart, you know, stepping in and being a heavy hitter that says, we aren't playing your game. And we're seeing many more, and I've talked to a lot of admissions reps that say they're just waiting for their board to basically okay, they're pulling away from and accepting tests optional or not even playing the game as well. So I think we're going to see many more schools that are going to follow suit with testing. So,
well, that's exactly it. It takes one heavy hitter at the top to be brave and take that step. And once they do, they can, of course, they have their brand and their recognition. Once they do that, all the other schools will follow suit. Something very similar happened recently in the law school admissions field, where Harvard started taking the GRE. And once they did, all the other top 14 law schools started taking the GRE also. Yeah. And once the GRE spread, then the LSAT sped up its adoption of the digital format. Yeah. And so it's interesting now with the SAT starting to go to the computerized format. I do wonder how that will affect your potential cheating of this nature. If things are really measured and documented and it's there in the hard drive, I do think that at least we'll avoid some of this sort of thing that happened with the proctors this time around.
So we kind of touched on the scandal a bit, but you know, you had mentioned that you specialize in activities because that's really what helped you stood out with Columbia. And so I guess, why don't we talk a little bit about how students can still stand out and improve their odds at admissions without faking their resume as we're
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. And so I'm thinking about it, especially since we were just discussing how going test optional could then make the other components of the application relatively more important because you've removed the SAT or ACT piece of the pie there. And so the idea that I have, I talked a bit before we started recording, but this idea of designing an extracurricular. And it comes from this book by Cal Newport called How to Be a High School Superstar. I was actually featured in that book for my own experience in high school, where I ended up going to a United Nations conference the summer before my senior year of high school to lobby government delegates on sustainable development. And you're like, what? How could somebody possibly end up there as a high school student? We don't have any frame of reference for it. And Cal Newport calls it the failed simulation effect, where we cannot imagine ourselves or our children doing the same thing for themselves because you don't even necessarily know where to start.
Yep.
And personally, I didn't know where to start. I did not have a plan in mind for myself that I was going to go end up in South Africa at a UN conference when I was a high school kid. All I knew is that I wanted to be involved in politics. I wanted to do things that were outside of my high school. And so, of course, you can go and get the leadership position within the high school. You could be the president of a club or the editor-in-chief of the paper. And that's great. And you should do that if you want to. But the problem is that every other high school in the country also has a club like this, like yours. It also has a newspaper like your child's. And so it's not going to stand out in the same way. But if you go beyond the kind of like the radius of your high school and step out of that bubble into the real world, I think you'll find there's much more out there where your child will be the only kid in that space. And that opens up many doors. Mark, you're nodding. How do you relate to this?
Well, I've read Cal's book and I didn't know you were that person. So that's really, I'm going like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that Steve was a celebrity that high. So, but one of the things I think all of us, when we talk to admissions representatives, they talk about standing out. And much like you said, Steve, what separates you from the rest of the herd? And they often use the words, is the student, you know, are they intentional and creative in their selections of what they do? Are they courageous? Are they self-starters? Are they reflective in their activities that they participate in? And I think in your case, much like Cal highlighted, it's basically, this is not every person participating in the normal high school activities of DECA and on down the line. It's something that was driven by a self-initiated and a self-perpetuated, you know, as something creative and something that was of intrigue to you. And that's, I think, the thing that if a student can highlight why they took the initiative, why they chose something particular, and talk about what they learned from that particular experience, that's what's going to really separate them from every other student who has exactly the same laundry list.
And I think it's different in that, I haven't read the book, but I will now, because I know you're in it. I think the other difference is it has to be self-motivated, because when it's self-motivated, you're not asking yourself as much, can I do this? Mm-hmm. Is it possible? You're kind of letting the momentum of your passion carry you. And I feel like that is so easy for admissions to see in a resume when they interview you, you know, versus something fabricated, which, you know, I mentioned this before we hopped on, you know, some people will work with students to identify these unique activities, but if it doesn't come from a genuine place, it's very easy. Yeah, it's way worse, but it's very easy to spot students in which the passion wasn't the thing that carried them to these activities. And you do find, I feel like, that those students have a special spark to them. I don't know if you've felt that way with the students you've worked with before too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I think you've got to have the spark. This can't be a parent like harassing their kid to go like send out emails and cover letters and things like that. You could harass your kid to send out 5-10 emails. The emails are going to be terrible, and you need to do way more than 10, honestly. Like, when I was looking to do my UN thing, I wasn't looking to do a UN thing. I just wanted to do something in politics. So I emailed like over 100 nonprofits just asking for an internship as a high school kid. And you've got to do that many, especially if it's a high school kid, because most people don't want to deal with a high school kid, which is natural. It's okay. But that all that means is that your child has to try harder, and they're only going to try that hard and be okay with getting 99 rejections or sending their application to a black hole, right? They're only going to be willing to do that if they really, really want it. And so you can't choose the domain for your child. I would suggest you take your child's passions and then try to channel them in a particular direction, but let them take the reins on it.
And we know that admissions recognizes any student, any teen who takes the initiative to be that vulnerable and courageous and put themselves out there. Like you said, contact 100 people and maybe get 99 no's. That's the kind of initiative and pursuing something that you're passionate about. The schools go, that's the kind of student who is going to be successful at our school just because they are so driven and they take initiative, like you said. And I think that's one thing this year, and I work mostly with a lot with STEM students. And one of the things that I actually ask them, especially if they're going into engineering, so many kids want to be an engineer. And I said, well, what have you built recently? And they go, well, I haven't built anything. I went like, that's a major part of engineering is that build design concept. And I challenged the student. I said, well, build something. And the next thing I know, he started building a boat from scratch.
Wow.
And, you know, and some, he got plans off the internet, went out and researched what kind of wood he needed on down the line. And I said, document everything you do, talk about what you learned specifically. And it turned into probably one of the best essays I've read in a long time, just basically because it was so personal. Like you said, Steve, was it driven by personal interest? Was it related to something that you might want to study later? And then talk about and document, what is the evidence that you learned something and what was it?
I love the idea of documenting, because I think that now with technology, it's easier than ever to do that, no matter what your area of interest is. Like, you could take photos, you could take videos, you could put it all on a website or a YouTube channel or something like that. And just documenting the journey all along the way, and then proof's in the pudding. And, you know, a picture really is a thousand words, and it proves that you actually did this, and you that energy shines through, I think.
That's totally true. So let's talk a little bit about, because I know like summer is upon us, and I know for a lot of the students, they are panicking that they don't have summer plans. So what are, you know, let's talk a little bit about summer programs, which I know Mark is such a fan of, and also about what you can do, how it's okay if you're not in a summer program, and how we can help them, you know, what tips we have for designing that special activity.
Hey, Mark, you want to jump off on this one?
Sure. And Anna, since Anna teed me up on summer programs and working with STEM students, they're all worried about, okay, these colleges that are STEM oriented and STEM focused, I'd like to go to these particular schools. They have these summer programs. Is it necessary that I go take their summer program and go through that to be able to get in and be more competitive? And I let them know, and just like we talked about, it really doesn't matter what they're looking for. While you may get you may be introduced to some things about the university or college, and they may get to know you a little bit better, and you can talk about that in your application. They still want to know, do you have the characteristics that they're looking for, that they know over time traditionally are held by the students that are most successful at their university? So you can do those kind of activities and provide evidence of all the things that we just talked about by designing your own, or just doing something of your own initiative and creating, basically, like Steve said, it's so easy to document, so easy to take pictures, and you record, and basically that can turn into your body of evidence that supports why you're pursuing a particular university or college, and their mission matches your mission. So that, I think, is the big thing. Don't necessarily look for a program. Look for what is evidence-based of your learning.
I was just going to say that you could take that $3,000 to $5,000 that you would have spent on this program for your kid, spend it on a video camera, or even just an extra smartphone to use to actually document this experience, or buy the materials to build Mark's boat, or whatever it might be. It takes a little bit more creativity and maybe a little bit more upfront planning than just handing over the signed check to the organization. But I think it's more worthwhile in the end, especially because, once again, you'll be the only one doing this activity, whether it's building something or whether it's holding an event or starting a nonprofit organization or partnering with other students or a teacher or a mentor. I think that with a little bit of upfront planning and creativity, you can do so much more and be the only applicant who's ever done something like that.
Exactly. And the thing is, people, I think a lot of students don't realize, students have been doing this for a long time, in that I like to point to Bill Gates, because when he was in high school, he designed and built basically a counter that was a traffic counter for the area here in Seattle. And that was, it was driven out of initiative. He basically wanted to see if he could do it. That is the kind of thing that, I mean, if you're talking about building something and providing evidence of community involvement and interest, those, you know, just point and shoot and document, that's it.
And I would also add that you don't, because I feel like a lot of my students, they get scared because they're like, well, what if I fail? What if this doesn't work out? And what I would add, and especially as evidenced by Steve, right, it demonstrates resilience and tenacity. And that is a quality Mark and I heard at conferences that colleges are really looking for these days from their applicants. And know that even documenting your failures is an awesome thing to do too. So you don't have to feel like it's not so much the success of whatever you're doing, but the effort that you put in to try, and those lessons and the reflections that you have in the process, that's what's really important when you're designing your own activity.
One of the things in this boat build that I was talking about, the student in the essay basically put, you know the phrase, measure twice, cut once. I learned that quickly. it's just such a great, I mean, anybody who's done it realizes, yep, you learned something very valuable.
I thought you were going to say it sunk. The book.
One of the other parts of the essay was, I learned that buoyancy is an important property.
Yeah.
If you do it right, it's called drowning.
What you're looking at is boat 3.0. The other two are at the bottom of the ocean.
Exactly.
But this theme of failure and being okay with it, I think is so important, because I think colleges, they do want to see tenacity, and they want to see that you've dealt with adversity in some way. And that could be adversity that was imposed upon you, or mm-hmm. adversity that you chose to take on. And whether you document a success or a failure, the fact is that you tried either way. And obviously, you're still coming back swinging for the next round, the next attempt. And if you're not failing at least once a week, once a month, once a year, it probably means that you're not trying hard enough or dreaming big enough.
Yeah, you're not pushing the envelope.
And I think that was part of the scary part about the scandal too, is I'm a parent, and while my daughter is not applying for college yet, this fear of letting your children fail, or this fear of letting your child be disappointed. And I think as parents, we need to take a step back. That's another reminder from the scandal, I think, is to let your kids go out there, and whatever they are capable of, they are capable of. And at least they'll be proud of what they're capable of. So I think that's the other piece to it.
Having been in education long enough, we talk about social pendulums, where it goes so far one way, and then there's opposition, it pushes it the other way, and then back and forth. And we had basically the generation of kids that were, oh no, everything's right, we want to set you up, make sure that you do everything good and that you feel good about yourself. I've now got parents that specifically talk about, oh no, I set him up so he would fail. And I'm going like, oh no, I knew he was, no, there was no way he was going to be successful at that. And the idea of, no, it's important that you bump into adversity and find out what it feels like, so that when it really happens in real life, adulting, that you know what to do. You've had practice at failure and pulling yourself back in on track. So I think we're kind of getting that pendulum swing back now. I don't necessarily suggest you set up for failure, but...
Well, I think ultimately we have to find a balance, right? You know, as counselors advising families, I think that it's our job to somewhat advise parents to let their children take some risks, yes, but still have a safety net in the end. So maybe obviously we come back to school selection, right? You know, you have your reaches, you have your matches, and you have your safeties. And I think it's important for us to encourage families to be okay with any of the options that may ultimately fall upon them. You know, it's obviously we want to shoot for reach schools whenever possible, but also be okay with not necessarily having the outcome, and help both the parents and the student find a way to be okay with any of those 9 or 10 schools, if that's how long our list is.
I think all counselors, we run into the question, we get this consistently from parents: should a student take a class that's going to challenge them and they may get a 3.8, or should they take the easier class and get a 4.0 and not have to work as hard? And I think this is one of those times when, and we're hearing this from admissions as well, they want to see as rigorous a course as possible, and they want you to do as well as possible. And I think in the essays and in the other parts of the application, and even recommendations, if you have a teacher who speaks about, I knew this class was going to be a challenge for them, and they came in every day for help, and they took everything that I said to heart and implemented it to get the best grade. It was the hardest working 3.8 I've ever seen. That kind of recommendation will stand out in ways that well, this student got a 4.0 in my class, will never do.
So you brought up a great point, because you said as IECs, we challenge our students and push them to stretch a little bit. So let's take a discussion, because obviously the person at the center of a scandal was not a true consultant. I think they're burning that off. But what do we bring to the table that, you know, and why do we exist? Because some people think, you know, we are just an advantage for the rich. And I think we would all disagree about that, but let's talk about why there are independent consultants and what we bring to the table.
Well, I think part of it even relates to this very issue of which class do you take, and really getting a sense of what is the student capable of, what's going to work for the parents as well, and what's going to set the kid up for success in the end. I'm based in New York, and the high schools here tend to get pretty big. You know, you have high school. I live right near Brooklyn Tech, one of the top high schools in New York City, and there's thousands and thousands of kids there. And as one of the top schools, will probably have a good number of counselors, but the ratios, I think, are one of the biggest issues I see, where a lot of students go the entire academic year, or even a couple of years, without ever really having a deep conversation with their counselor. And so I think the level of personalization and depth we can offer is one of the biggest things. Also, we're specializing in college in particular, of course.
That's true. The other thing I would say, in addition, as a result of that, what I found from the different cases I worked with, and I feel so bad because high school counselors work really hard and they're stretched so thin that sometimes all they can manage is that letter of recommendation for you. Yep. All they can manage is helping you pick your classes. So there's not much time for counseling, which is actually their favorite part too. But the other challenge is when they have so many students, I found that what ends up happening is they choose to focus on the really shining stars and the kids that really need help the most. And so everyone else in between kind of gets like left off. And so I think that's the other reason sometimes people seek extra help, is just because their kids just not getting the attention they need.
When I was getting my doctorate in education, I took most of the coursework on for counselors. And so I've done a lot of that work, and I know a lot of counselors, and having been a high school teacher for a decade, I know their job intimately, and I know how hard they work and what is thrown at them daily. And so one of the things as a counselor, I know that their numbers are over 350. I mean, the average nationally is over 350 students to one counselor. They would love to be able to spend more time individually with students and focus on the good parts, the things like college prep and college readiness and all of those things. They would love to do that, but there just aren't that many hours in the day. So one of the things as a counselor here in town, I really try to reach out to those at private and public high schools to let them know what I do and my background. So they know I've been in the trenches and they know that I appreciate what they do. And so they recognize that there are things that I can do just because of the number of students that I serve and my background that they can't. But they also know the reason why I'm actually providing that kind of information to students is because of my mission to buoy up all students. And I think that's one thing that counselors in schools and counselors who do just admissions, a lot of times they come to loggerheads because they don't realize we have the same mission. It's to serve students, and we all do better when we all do better. And I think that's one of the things that really trying to offer those olive branches and show counselors in school and vice versa, how can we best serve students? And I think that's one of the things that IECs can fill that gap of all the things that school counselors would love to be able to do anyway.
And I think the other piece is the scandal obviously made it seem like we make gazillions of dollars, and so did the media articles after that. Most of us work pro bono too. So it's not like we're money hungry. I mean, we do all have to make a living, so that's why we charge fees. But at the same time, we also work with pro bono clients, you know, too. And we really do, you know, believe in bringing access. But also, let's take a moment to talk about, you know, now that we know like why we exist, what we bring to the table. So you're right, we do everything from counseling on high school courses to, you know, I love the essay process, especially, and interviews, because I used to be an alumni viewer. But, you know, Steve, you're probably, you know, you probably specialize in activities, right? And resumes.
Yeah. So I help students a lot with both designing and crafting their activities themselves, as well as how they describe them and kind of tell the story of their activity, their why, especially the why, like the who, what, when, where, why, essentially, and the how. Yes. Every step of that process, incorporating that into, of course, the main college essay, as well as all the supplemental essays, and then any short answers or resumes and things of that nature.
And Steve, I also love the essay, because I think more or less a lot of the things that I do during setting the foundation and asking critical questions of students to have them identify who they are and what they're about, so that that comes through in an essay. I love watching that growth process. When you, one of the issues that I have with a lot of students is they, and I don't, you'll have to let me know if this happens in New York as well. I think it does. You have a student who is writing an essay for their language arts class that is the college essay. And it's driven by a teacher who has all the best intentions. And that student is going to be graded on a specific way of writing an essay. And I tell students, that's great. You want to do that. You want to learn that academic version of an essay. However, we're going to write another one that showcases all of the things that you bring and all the things that admissions representatives have told us they want to see. Do you run into that as well?
Yes, yes, I absolutely do. And I like that you said academic, because I think that kind of highlights the problem in a way.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, this is not an academic process, although college is academic in nature, of course. It's personal. It has to be personal. And it is so hard. It's consistently hard, I think, for students of all stripes to get personal and truly get authentic and vulnerable in their essays. And so it is kind of like peeling away layers of an onion bit by bit every step of the process. But of course, the academic version for the language arts teacher or the initial rough draft will, of course, look very different from the final product as it gets increasingly personal and deep every step of the way.
How do you, now, obviously we all work with teens and sometimes they don't want to open up right away. They're like shut like clams. What techniques do you use, kind of, Steve, to open up? Obviously, you look very young. No offense, Mark. you're very young at heart, Mark. But what techniques do you find useful in opening up your students?
That's a great question. I think it does, you know, being a bit on the younger side does tend to help a little bit just in terms of relatability. But obviously, we can all go on Urban Dictionary and learn the latest terms and everything. But I think that part of it just comes from trying to be a real person, you know, outside the academic space, especially because we're not their guidance counselor. We're someone that they're meeting in a different context. I try to connect over Skype like it's a friend catching up on Skype, I think is one thing, but also really just being a human, having a conversation, taking some time to get things warmed up a little bit and build the relationship. And then if I find a little sliver of something opening. Deeper, a little opening. Yeah, I'll try to go there bit by bit. But it does take time. It takes some patience, kind of coax, a little bit of coaxing. One thing I love to do with college essays, and I imagine you both might do similar, is I'll have students write a rough draft that's 3 to 4 times the length of what the ultimate final draft will be. So if we're talking 650 words for the Common App, I'll have them do 2,500, and then we'll chop it down bit by bit. But it can take 2,000 words or 3,000 words to actually find that sliver of authenticity. And then we'll just work on expanding that.
Yep. That's such a great point. I often tell them that, like, the essay, in terms of how personally you want to get, you want, it is like talking to a friend or giving us a snapshot of your day or of your journal or diary that no one else gets a glimpse into. But you're right. I think you brought up a really great point in that it takes time. So that's why, you know, great essays can't be rushed. And, you know, working with someone definitely helps, because they do it at a pace that works for the student.
One of the ways that I've found that students really are able to open up some of those vulnerable spots without knowing it, and as a psychologist, I use some of the tools in that toolkit, and I'll have a list of words. Tell me the time you were most vulnerable, most happy, most embarrassed, most sad, most frightened, and just basically one sentence. I just want one sentence. Identify when those. And it's amazing, like you say, Steve, all you need is that opening. And then they realize, oh, there's something there. And they talk about something that is authentic and personal. And that is where we can then start to build that essay. And I like to call them the ugly first drafts. And I'm now going to call them the ugly long first draft. I think I'm going to steal that from you, Steve.
Yeah. And you also, obviously, I don't think we really dived into it, but, you know, I think it's really hard for a teen, or to ask a teen, like, what is your passion? And expect them to follow their passion for most kids. So I guess, what advice do you have as, you know, as an independent in helping them, you know, find the passion or to work on the designing of the activities?
I'll typically I'll ask them to give me a list, or we'll just talk about it, you know, list of hobbies, list of extracurriculars, list of things they like to do for fun. And we'll kind of talk through each of those a little bit. I might even have them write a short paragraph on each of those. Mm. And then we'll take it from there. And maybe we'll find the most compelling out of those 3 to 5 topics and try to expand on that bit by bit. But we could have a few different rough, ugly first drafts and see what we like the best and then take it from there. But it's okay to have a bad first draft. It's okay to have bad first draft. Do a bad job at it and start there. It doesn't have to be good. There's no stakes involved here. We're the only ones looking at this first draft. And then we can go and just take it from there and progress along the way.
I think everybody who's been anybody who talks to a successful author, poet, musician, they'll tell them, yeah, this one was good. You want to hear the 100 others that sucked? And I think that's one thing that's really hard for students, because they're afraid of failure and not understanding that writing something bad isn't failure. It's just, that's now you know that's not the direction you want to go. And that's really hard for a teen who's trying to have this big 650 word monster that has so much pressure that they don't understand. It's just a personal statement about who you are and what you believe. And that's a tough one to get across. If you can cross that bridge, a lot of them, they'll open up and write something extraordinary.
Yeah, I think the big thing is a lot of times kids think, I have to impress them. And I think the more they try to impress, the more they get further away from the genuine, authentic story that we're looking for. So I think putting that out there that they don't need you to impress them, they don't like it when you impress them, definitely kind of helps reduce the expectations so that they can produce something a little more genuine.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely. Well, this has been a pleasure, folks. What do you say we wrap it up here?
Yeah, this has been great. Thanks so much, Steve. I'm so glad we all got to get together.
Yeah, Sim, I'm really glad we connected. This was a great collaboration, and it was great to finally meet both of you. What's the best way for folks to check out your podcast and your other online platforms?
Great. So Mark and I are on iTunes, now called College Admissions with Mark and Anna. And we're also on our website, collegeadmissionspodcast.com.
Well, folks, I definitely encourage folks listening on my end to check out the collegeadmissionspodcast.com and then College Admissions with Mark and Anna on iTunes and I assume Spotify and everywhere else. Folks can find me at collegeadmissionstoolbox.com. And my podcast, College Admissions Toolbox, is on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and everywhere else as well.
Thanks for listening to College Admissions with Mark and Anna, where we make getting into college easy and fun. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and subscribe to get updated each time we release a new episode. Also, for more helpful college admissions information, visit our website at www.collegeadmissionspodcast.com.